Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics number 6, and in this episode we're going to be covering Bitcoin. Now, confession to you guys, whenever I'm writing these Brokenomics series, the biggest problem I have is not what to include in an episode, but it's what to leave out. And when I started reading and the notes that I put together for this episode, I started to realise that I had far too much to possibly fit into one episode. So I'm going to have to rationalise it, and this is going to have to be about the fundamentals of Bitcoin, how it works on a technical basis, because I appreciate there's probably going to be a lot of people who have no idea how Bitcoin really works, the fundamentals of it. I could take that for granted in the last episode when we were talking about gold, because I think everybody understands gold. It is a shiny, heavy metal that if you drop it on your foot, you say, ow. But what's really going on with Bitcoin? But then, of course, what I'm also going to have to do in this series, I'm going to have to explain it in a way in about half an hour that you can explain it to your mates down the pub after having watched this video. So it is going to be oversimplified, and that's why I turn to the first book on the reading list, which is going to be this one, Mastering Bitcoin. If you want to go deep in this and you want to understand how it really works without my oversimplifications, then get this and go into that. But other than that, let's get into a simplified fundamentals of Bitcoin. So you've probably heard that Bitcoin was invented by somebody called Satoshi Nakamoto. We don't know who Satoshi Nakamoto was. There are a few possible candidates of the people who had the sort of technical skills. It's a pretty short list. There was actually a guy called Dorian Nakamoto, whose birth name was Satoshi Nakamoto, who had the technical skills to be able to do this. He also had the sort of philosophy that you might think that would encourage him to do so. He was very libertarian. According to his daughter, when he would chase around the house playing hide and seek, for example, he would shout, "I'm the government, I'm coming to get you," because that was the scariest thing that he could think of. So he had the right mindset and he had the technical skills. But I actually think that the guy who was really Satoshi Nakamoto was this guy. Let's throw him up on screen. His name is Hal Finney, and he was an old school cyberpunk. So he was in a group that included people like Julian Assange and Bram Cohen, who was the creator of BitTorrent. The reason I think it was Hal Finney is because he was a software engineer, a very good one, who had the skills to do this. He was a leader on the PGP project, which was basically an encryption method for you to be able to send messages to people anywhere in the world that were unbreakable, essentially using the same sort of encryption methodology. So he was a leader on that, and that was basically the tech that Bitcoin was then later built on. Hal was also the first guy to start mining Bitcoin, and he was also the first guy to receive a Bitcoin transaction from Satoshi Nakamoto, which was, I think, was his pseudonym. Now, we don't know this for sure. This is simply my speculation. But one of the things I would point out is that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that person was, built up 1 million Bitcoins, which is worth, well, an extraordinary amount of money at this point, in a wallet. And none of those Bitcoins have ever been spent. Indeed, Satoshi Nakamoto disappeared from the scene in 2011, was never heard from again. And it just so happens that Hal Finney, I'm suggesting is possibly the creator of this, he became very ill in 2011 and he left work and he sadly died a few years later. So possibly the reason those 1 million Bitcoins have never been moved and never been spent is because the creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, is no longer with us. And one other cute point is that Hal Finney and Dorian Nakamoto lived very close to each other, only a few streets away, so they may well have known each other and collaborated. So that's what I think is possibly the creator of it. That's a lot of speculation so far. And it all kicked off with a Bitcoin white paper, which we're going to throw up on screen here. You can go and read it yourself. It is actually a fairly short document. It's only a few pages. And if you're technically minded, I'm sure you'd get something out of that. Now, what that paper did is it solved something really important, which was how can you convey value digitally? And that was something that we couldn't do before. You know, the joke before was, you know, you could send, you could send artwork or something like that. You could send something to somebody electronically. And of course, there's no point asking for it back again because the digital copies, you can make as many of them as you like. So how are you able to express value in a digital world? And that was the problem that Satoshi Nakamoto through that white paper solved. And it is a fundamental revolution. I'm going to come back to why I think it's so important later on. But first of all, I want to explain to you in oversimplified terms how a blockchain works. So a blockchain is quite simply a chain of blocks, okay? And each of these blocks contain information. So my oversimplified analogy of how a Bitcoin blockchain works is imagine you go to the pub with the people from your office or, you know, wherever, whatever group you're in. And you decide to do a bit of a weird system. You're not going to go and buy each other rounds or buy your own drinks. What you're going to do is you're going to buy drinks for other people, and everybody is sat at a table with a notepad. And whenever you buy a drink for somebody else, you shout that out to the pub, and everybody copies it down, a copy of that, in their notepad. And then they go to another line. And basically all night long this happens. People buy drinks for each other, they shout it out, and they record it in this notebook. And what you end up with at the end of the night is a complete record of who's bought who what, where the transactions have gone, how much those transactions were for. And from that, basically that series of ledgers in different locations, these different nodes, you can work out the state of affairs, who owes each other what. Now, that's overcomplicated for going for the pub, but that's a nice way of thinking about how blockchains work. That's pretty much what's going on. The difference with Bitcoin and the blockchain that's there is that these blocks are created roughly every 10 minutes, and it's linked to whenever new Bitcoin are mined. And so a blockchain is basically just the Bitcoin blockchain is basically just a very long list of, starting from zero, all the Bitcoin that have ever been mined, and then all of the transactions that have occurred since. And then, so once you look at that blockchain, because you have that complete record, you can work out from that where all of the Bitcoin are now. So you have a current state of affairs simply from knowing the starting conditions for each of the Bitcoin, and then how they've moved throughout the system. So you're able to tally up and present yourself with a current view of where you are at that particular time. So I've introduced the notion there of Bitcoin mining. And that's really important. This is where Bitcoin gets its security, and it is cryptographic security. So we know that new blocks need to be mined, and people need to be incentivized in order to create those new blocks. So what happens is every time a new block is mined, you get a reward. At the moment, that reward is, I think, 6.25 Bitcoin. So if you mine a Bitcoin block, you get 6.5 Bitcoin. And you also get a little transaction fee for all of the transactions that happened that have attached themselves to that block that's being embedded in the blockchain so that the next block can be built on top of it. Now, that's quite a good reward because, you know, even at these prices, and I'm sure you're aware that the price of Bitcoin has come down quite a bit over the last year. It is a very volatile asset if measured in fiat currencies, and it has come down. But even at the time of recording, when Bitcoin is quite low, 6.25 Bitcoin is about £90,000. So it is well worth solving a Bitcoin block and getting that reward and adding that onto the chain. Now, what's actually happening here is, well, you are solving a cryptographic problem, which is very, very hard. In fact, it's so hard that it is extremely unlikely that anyone would ever solve the problem. So what happens is the computers start to guess. And again, another big oversimplification coming. But at the moment, the complexity of solving a Bitcoin block is something like flipping a coin 16 times and getting heads every single time. I'll throw up on the screen just how unlikely that is in terms of a percentage. And basically what computers do is they start guessing the solution to this cryptographic problem. It's not actually like a coin flip. Actually, the way it works is you need to generate a certain number of zeros at the start of a hex sequence that they produce. And if you guess and all the numbers at the beginning turn to zeros and that's it, you've solved the problem. You get awarded the block reward, and you get the benefit from that, and you've created that next block and all the transactions are attached onto it. So computers, they start guessing millions of times a second to solve this cryptographic problem. And in the early days, it was actually relatively easy. So in the early days, a laptop like this, well, I mean, this is quite a good laptop, but the laptops that were around in 2010 were perfectly sufficient in order to mine Bitcoin. And actually the block rewards were higher then as well. You used to get 50 Bitcoin every time you solved a block, and blocks were getting created every 10 minutes. And basically what the algorithm does is if blocks are getting created too quickly, they make the cryptographic challenge harder to bring it back down to 10 minutes. And if it's taking too long, so if there's more than an average of 10 minutes between each block, they make it easier. So the algorithm is constantly adjusting so that every 10 minutes on average, and I have seen it where a block has been solved and then a few seconds later another block has been solved. And I have seen it go the other way. It might be half an hour between a block getting solved. But on average, it is actually pretty good, especially the blockchain is at the size that it is now. So it's fairly regular. About every 10 minutes it gets solved. Now, this... this cryptographic security is vital because it is these days a little laptop is not going to solve you this. I mean, theory it could, but that's unlikely. The way people do it these days is they do it with these things that I'm going to show up on screen, which is something called an ASIC, an application specific integrated circuit, something like that. So it's basically a very powerful computer, which is built solely for the purpose of running the SHA-256 algorithm, which tries to find Bitcoin, and for that purpose alone. And so there's these very powerful dedicated machines, and people are actually running whole server farms of these. So you will find locations where there are warehouses, huge warehouses, and racks and racks and racks of these machines from floor to ceiling, and all they're doing is constantly guessing the solution to this incredibly difficult cryptographic solution in the hope that one of them will guess the right answer, and on average every 10 minutes one of these machines somewhere will do it. So that's a lot of cryptographic power which is being used to secure the network. I want to explain what I mean by that, because what do I mean by secure it? Because let's say I bought something from you, something very valuable. And I paid for the thing that I just bought from you in Bitcoin. And you've seen that transaction go through. You've seen that you've got the Bitcoin deposited into your wallet. And so you hand me the very valuable thing that I've just paid for in Bitcoin. I might, if I'm a dishonest person, I might then want to try and reverse that transaction. So I could try and generate the next block. Assuming that this happens straight away, I could try and generate the next block that says, okay, well, actually, that transaction didn't happen, that part of the chain, that last part of the chain isn't valid. But in order to do that, what I would have to do is I would have to invest more computing power than the entire Bitcoin network on my side in order to spoof it so that the next block was one of mine. Now, at that point, that level of computing is beyond, I mean, maybe a government could do it if they really went for it, if they really invested all of their sort of resources, they might be able to create enough computing power on their territory to undo the last block. But trying to undo a block that happened, say, 3 weeks ago, it's just impossible at this point, because not only would you need to have more computing power than the entire Bitcoin network itself has, you would need to have more computing power than the entire network has, multiplied by, you know, the number of blocks since the block that you're trying to change. So through this mining process, Bitcoin transactions are incredibly secure because all of those computers are providing that level, that high level of cryptographic security. So this is something I'm going to be coming back to many times when we talk about the fundamentals of Bitcoin. It is very, very secure. And as a result, Bitcoin has never been hacked, not once in its 10-year life, because as the attention grows on it, as the value of the Bitcoin grows, so does the computing power that goes into providing that cryptographic security. So we know that transactions are incredibly secure. Now, I mentioned that it started off at a block reward of 50 bitcoins every 10 minutes. That gets halved about every 4 years, something like that. So it went down from 50 to 25 to, you know, 12 and a half, now to 6 and a quarter. And in a couple of years, it's going to go down to 3 and a bit bitcoin per reward. And it's going to keep halving down until about 2140. So we've got another 120 years of Bitcoin being mined, but every time the block reward that you get will get smaller and smaller and smaller. However, because as Bitcoin is being used more, what you'll find as a miner is that the transaction reward that you get goes up and up and up. So actually the most valuable blocks to be mined will probably be mined, you know, long into the future, because the value of those transactions are going up over time. Now, at this point, I need to address the environmental impacts of Bitcoin mining, because this is the big pushback against mining. Because I've told you that we've got these dedicated facilities across the world of these large Bitcoin mining operations that are generating an enormous amount of heat, using an enormous amount of energy to secure this. And that is true. A couple of pushbacks, though. Firstly, the logic of the mining business basically pushes you very, very strongly to find the lowest cost energy sources that you possibly can. Because, you know, that's a lot of cost, running a lot of energy through these machines. So in order to be the most competitive miner, in order to be able to plow back more back into the computing hardware and the capital and so on, you want your marginal cost of Bitcoin production to be as close as possible to zero, which basically pushes people to use renewable energy. So one of the things that you've seen with Bitcoin mining quite strongly, actually, is a whole bunch of mothballed hydroelectric plants have been reactivated with Bitcoin miners, because then of course your marginal cost of energy is pretty close to zero, even though there's some maintenance of the facility, so it pushes it to that. And another thing that it does is there's various other things it does on the energy front. So it makes a business case for stranded energy. So one of the things I've talked about on the podcast is that the UK is actually fairly good for wind energy, because we're an island in the Atlantic and it's windy, if that's the case. But actually the windiest spot in the UK is basically that northwest part of Scotland. Wind turbines are remarkably efficient if you put them there. There's actually a good business case for wind turbines if you stick them there. The reason they don't is because no bugger lives there, maybe like a man and a dog or something, but not many people live in that bit of Scotland. But it would be very viable to do it there. So what Bitcoin does is it allows a business case for energy sources that are remote and potentially stranded to get up to scale to the point where high capacity electricity lines can be put in and that energy can be used elsewhere. It makes a business case for things like peaker energy plants. So one of the problems that we have with this transition to renewables that our betters have decided that they're going to do whether we want it or not, a reliance on wind only works when the wind blows. A reliance on solar obviously only works when the sun shines. And so you need these peaker plants, which are sort of sat in the background, ready to go. But you know they sort of need to. You can't just flip them on and off. They're not Christmas tree lights, you basically need to sort of ramp them up and ramp them down broadly in line where you sort of expect them to be. And so a lot of that energy gets wasted, but you need to do it because otherwise the energy isn't there when the sun's not shining or it stops being windy or whatever it is. And so again, Bitcoin allows those peaker energy plants to have a business case beyond being quite as wasteful as they are now with our slightly mad energy policies that they're doing. And other things as well. So like, you know, flares from oil rigs, you know, you've seen those flares that go up because they're just basically burning off excess energy, but they haven't got something to do. A lot of those are now turning that into Bitcoin mining because there's energy to do there. And the other thing I'd say, the biggest pushback I'd have on this, despite questioning the ethos behind the whole energy revolution anyway, is to point out that actually our current monetary system wastes an extraordinary amount of energy. So, you know, what is our current monetary system based on? The US dollar. What underpins the US dollar? The US military. Now, if you think that a few warehouses full of ASICs burn a lot of energy, you know, you start comparing that to a bloody aircraft carrier or Humvees or, you know, whatever the latest war that we've decided needs to last forever. So it's not something that I particularly resonate, but those are the arguments against it. Which are actually quite good. I mean, if we are going to do the energy revolution, we might as well make some money out of it while we're doing it. So, next thing on the fundamentals of how Bitcoin works is a Bitcoin wallet. Now, all of the Bitcoin are actually stored on the blockchain itself. What we're really talking about when we're saying where are those Bitcoin stored is who has the keys to be able to access them off of the blockchain. And I'm going to give you a very simplistic example again. Here, I'm going to show you this thing, which is a paper wallet. Now, you can see the address at the top there. You can go to this website and you can generate a paper wallet. And it is quite literally a case of using these two keys on here, the public key and the private key. And that will allow you to access your Bitcoin from off of the blockchain and do various things with it. So let's talk about these two keys because they are fundamental to how Bitcoin works. So firstly, the public key. Now, if you have the public key, you can send to that wallet Bitcoin. So the public key is something that you are perfectly happy to promote. In fact, if you ever found yourself with a Bitcoin wallet and for some weird reason you had access to a billboard, you might want to put your public key on that billboard because the only thing that people can do with that public key is see how much you have in your wallet and they can send Bitcoin into that wallet. So that one is, like the name says, it's public and you want it to be public. The private key is very, very different. The private key allows you to send Bitcoin from that wallet to somewhere else, so effectively to spend it. So you want that private key to be as private as possible. You want that to be secure. So whenever you hear people talking about where they store their Bitcoin, what they really mean is who is in charge of that private key. Now, the example that I'm showing is the simplest possible example, which is written down on a piece of paper. I don't recommend doing that, by the way. It just illustrates the point quite nicely that it can be done in this mechanism. The best way to do it is actually through having it on a wallet that you secure on your computer or something like a hardware wallet, something like a Trezor or Ledger. We throw up an example of those on the screen. Those are things that you can get hold of if you want to go and basically get hold of any Bitcoin yourself. You're going to need a wallet. So this was the whole talk with FTX recently. If you remember, people were saying that they had left their crypto assets, including their Bitcoin, on FTX. What they actually mean by that is that FTX were holding their private keys for them, which meant that they could send the Bitcoin. And of course, FTX did exactly that. They took all of the assets that people put on there and they sent them to their own little hedge fund, Alameda Research, and they spent it on gambling and backing the Democrats in the midterms and all that kind of thing. So the private key is something that you want to hang on to. Now, you're probably looking at this and thinking, right, so you're telling me that in order to spend your Bitcoin, all you need is that key. And presumably there are a finite number of keys. So what is to stop somebody from basically tapping in random keys until they hit a live wallet with something in it and essentially hacking your Bitcoin? Well, the answer is nothing. That is entirely possible. You can just type in random Bitcoin wallets. The problem that you've got is that there are an awful, awful lot of them. So the total number of Bitcoin wallets is, and now we show this on the screen, it's the number is 2 to the power of 256. Now, I'm no mathematician chap, but apparently that is a really, really, really large number. In fact, that number is larger than the estimated total number of particles that exist in the entire universe. So it's a really big number. Let's give an example of how long it would take to crack it. So let's assume that everybody on Earth gets a Bitcoin wallet, that Bitcoin is very successful and everybody starts using it, and so everybody has a wallet. So there are 8 billion wallets all over the planet. Now let's assume that you had in your possession the world's most powerful supercomputer, which is apparently it is the Fujitsu Fugaku, which is a supercomputer in Japan, which is ranked currently the most powerful supercomputer going. So if you had the Fujitsu Fugaku and you tasked it with trying out random Bitcoin addresses to try and find one of these 8 billion with something in it, how long would it take of random guesses until you got one of those 8 billion? Not necessarily one with loads of Bitcoin, it's just any one of those 8 billion that somebody on Earth had. Well, the answer is, and again, I'm going to have to throw this number up on screen because I would be here for quite a while if I said it, is the number of years that it would take to find any random Bitcoin wallet if everybody on Earth had one. The answer is it's 1 tredecillion years. I had to look up what that was called. So basically, it's a 1 with 42 zeros behind it. Now, to give you an example of just how unlikely that is 76 nonillion times longer than the universe has existed. It is so far into the future that not only will all of the stars have burnt out. And when I say all of the stars, I don't mean all of the stars that currently exist. I mean all of the stars that currently exist and all future generations of stars that we'd be born in the future, billions of years into the future. All of them will have burnt out. And in fact, a lot of the black holes will have started to evaporate at that point. So the point is that a Bitcoin wallet is incredibly secure. So we know that the transactions are incredibly secure. We know that the wallets are incredibly secure. This is the sort of key thing forward.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.